Shalom. When we talk about Hanukkah, we speak about its significance from all kinds of different points of view. There are those who emphasize the political element, the idea of freedom, rebellion against the oppression of the Greeks, and a forerunner of the present establishment of the State of Israel. Others emphasize the spiritual victory, the fact that this was a rebellion against religious oppression, against the desire on the part of the Syrian Greeks to homogenize all of society and to wipe out the Torah and wipe out Judaism. Also true. On another level, Nachmanides, the Ramban, likes to emphasize, or people like to emphasize in the name of the Ramban, the fact that this was a unique and pace-setting miracle and holiday, because for the first time in the land of Israel, we have a situation in which the victory or the salvation was wrought not with open, obvious Cecil B. DeMille type miracles, but it was done with through God working through history, what the Ramban likes to call a nes nistar, a hidden mystery, hidden miracle. You could easily explain the victory of the Hashmonaim as the victory of a very shrewd and very talented guerrilla war against a larger empire, and you wouldn't miss a beat. It's the fact that we believe that it wasn't just that the Rabim Ma'ad, the Biad Ma'atim, the element of the minority of a small group being able to conquer a large empire was none less than the venerable hand of God. And that set the tone for all of the future survival of the Jewish people, all of which was done through the means of an ace nistar and not through the means of big special effects types of miracles. In a sense, the Pach HaShemen, the little cruse of oil that we talk about, emblemizes that the fact that that miracle is the one that we emphasize. Goes straight to the matter of this star, because who saw it? Just the Kohanim that went into the Beis HaMikdash, they're the ones who saw it. Nobody else saw it, but we believe it was there because it was hidden from our sight, just like the Shechina and God's providence works behind the scenes and is not obvious, but you have to have a special kind of special kind of perception to be able to see it. Similarly, the entire miracle of the victory over the Syrian Greeks was in fact such a miracle. So all those are probably the major themes that we're going to be hearing about as Hanukkah starts on Wednesday night. On the other hand, I'd like to emphasize something else. Rav Soloveitchik used to make a major point of saying that Hanukkah is the holiday of Torah Sheval Peh. Initially, he said that, at least the way that I recall it, because Hanukkah is really the first holiday that does not appear in Kisui HaKodesh. Even Purim, which serves something of a precedent for it, got a book in the Bible. But the Book of Maccabees didn't make it into the canon. For whatever reason, Chazal decided not to include any of the four books of Maccabees in the Tanakh. So that the authority and the basis for Hanukkah is totally Torah Sheval Peh. And as a result, Hanukkah is the embodiment and the expression of Torah Sheval Peh. I would like to take that idea of Rav Soloveitchik, and I'd like to run with it in a different direction, because I think there are dimensions of the Hanukkah story that are not only not emphasized sufficiently, but I think that they actually have tremendous resonance for our present-day circumstances and for every generation, but certainly for today. I'd like to start with, of all things, a Mishnah. The Mishnah at the beginning of Pirkei Avot says as follows: Moshe kivel Torah b'Sinai u'misara li'Yoshua v'Yoshua l'zkenim u'zkenim l'neviim u'neviim misaru l'anshei Knesset HaGdola hem amru shlosha dvarim hevu metunim badin v'amidu tamidim harbe v'asu siyag l'Torah. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. He passed it on to, transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua transmitted it to the elders. The elders to the prophets. The prophets transmitted it to the members of the great assembly. Now, the last of the prophets, who were also members of Anshei Knesset HaGdola, we're talking about Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, whether, according to the Medrash, whether Malachi was Ezra or Malachi was Mordechai, there was a certain amount of transition. But for most of, but this happened historically in the 5th century. BCE. In other words, by the time the Maccabees, prophecy was long gone. That's number one. Number two, we don't appreciate, I don't think, sufficiently what it means not to have a prophet among us, not to have the veritable word of God available to us, accessible through the words of the prophet. And more than that, I think we don't think sufficiently what it meant for the leaders of the people, for the religious leaders of the people, for the Chachmei HaMasorah, for the sages of tradition, to in fact not have prophets anymore. Now, what I'm about to say doesn't really run well with Maimonides, and I understand that, but nevertheless, however one is going to square what I'm about to say with Maimonides, it's important to point out, I think, the lesson that I'd like to share. I would like to propose to you that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, especially after the deaths of the Achron HaNeviim, after Chagai, Zachariah, and Malachi, found themselves in a very, very unprecedented and to a large degree uncomfortable situation. Because without prophets, and even if the prophets, you know what, even if the prophets took no role qua prophet earlier in the process of halacha, which is certainly the Rambam's approach, nevertheless, they must have felt bereft. And I can prove to you that in fact they felt bereft, and that the persecutions of Antiochus and the response of the Jews to those persecutions highlighted that and forced them to be able to bring their involvement in Torah Shebaal Peh to a new level and demanded of them something which was really unprecedented. Let's start. I'd like to base my remarks now on a mixture of passages from the Book of Maccabees. I'm going to use an English translation and appropriate passages from Chazal, because I think that they meld together very well. In Maccabees chapter one, this is verses 41. I'm going to jump around a little bit. 41 through 64. The author writes as follows: Then the king, meaning Antiochus, wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and that each should give up his customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Even many from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. Now, Hellenism was by definition a leveling religion. It was a civilization that wanted to homogenize all peoples. This was the dream of Alexander the Great. And Antiochus, in this regard, is no different than anyone else. The Hellenists were convinced that they represented progress, that they represented universalism. As far as they were concerned, this was an improvement for mankind. Not to mention the fact that the payoff would have been politically that when you have a unified people, a unified emperor, despite the ethnic diversity of the Seleucid Empire, which Antiochus ruled over, if you have a common cultural and religious base, that will hold those fractious elements together. Anyways, then the king sent, this is verse 44, and the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, meaning Avodah Zarah, meaning Greek pagan rituals, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings, those nesachim, to the sanctuary, to profane the Shabbat and the festivals, to defile the sanctuary, and so on, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. It's interesting, today we have, there's a huge anti-circumcision movement. This started with the Greeks. The Greeks thought they worshipped the body. They worshipped the perfection of the body. And therefore, they thought that the Jews were, in fact, barbarians for circumcising their children. Let's skip a little bit. And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. We know this story. We know the story. On the 15th of Kislev, they put a statue of Zeus Olympus in the temple. They sacrifice swine on and so on and so forth. They also prohibited Talmud Torah. Verse 56, the books of the law which they found they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Don't forget, this is a period in which there are no other Svarim. There are no other books, because Torah Shebaal Peh is still oral. So whatever they can get their hands on, they're destroying. Where the book of the covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, to the Torah, the decree of the king condemned them to death. They kept using violence against Israel, against those found month after month in the cities, and on the 25th day of the month, in other words, on Hanukkah, a year a year earlier, they offered sacrifices on the altar, which was upon the altar of the burnt offering, in other words, the outside altar. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised, and their families, and those who circumcised them. And they hung the infants from their brothers, mother's necks. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than to be defiled by food and profane the holy covenant, and they did die. And very great wrath came upon Israel. Now, let me explain something to you. This is the first time in documented history that a kingdom has decided to pursue a policy of religious persecution. It had never happened before. Because by definition, paganism is eclectic. It's basically, I'm okay, you're okay, to quote a book that was very popular when I was in college. Everybody's all right, Dali, I'll worship your gods, you worship my gods. In fact, the Torah says, that what's the problem with over-socializing with pagans? Says Chumash, that you'll invite them, and they'll invite you, v'kara lecha v'chalta bizivcho. You know, you're expected, he's going to come to your house, he's going to expect it to worship Kadosh Baruch Hu, but then you'll be expected to go to his house and to worship his avodah zarah, which is something you can't do. But as far as they were concerned, this was exactly what you're supposed to. How, you know, this is manners. I worship your god, you worship my god. We're all okay. We're all cool. Interestingly, that's the reason why Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to interfaith dialogue on matters of faith. Because once you have sort of this sort of like even-handed, backslapping, I'm okay, you're okay kind of attitude, then serious lines can be violated, and the integrity of Jewish tradition can be, in fact, be impugned. In any event, we'll come back to that. That's sort of by the way. In any event, so paganism by definition is very tolerant. The Jews, if anything, were hated not because they worshipped their one God, but because they refused to worship anybody else's gods. They were accused of atheism, which means not that they didn't worship God, but they didn't worship the gods. In any event, it was very unusual. The case of Antiochus, like the case of Hadrian later, is very unusual against a pagan background. Nevertheless, this is the first time that the Jews were forced to face a situation which they had to choose between God and death. It was unparalleled. So we know all about the fact that in a time of religious persecution, that there are different halachas, and the Gemara and Sanhedrin records that they took a vote that whenever a non-Jew comes and asks you to worship a false worship, or to murder somebody, or to commit sexual immorality, whatever the case might be, you should yehareg val yavor, you should die rather than then violate the Torah. Otherwise, there's more leeway. Unless there's a unilateral universal persecution. The point is, however, that vote was only taken in the years before the Bar Kokhba revolt. That decision hadn't been reached yet. This was the first time, and there was no prophet. And the people and the Chachmei HaMasora, they had to decide what to do. When do you die? When do you not die? When do you pretend? When do you not pretend? Should you pretend? These are unparalleled. And there's nobody to tell them. They have to take responsibility. And they have to decide. So in this case, from what we know of the Maccabean martyrs, most people who stayed loyal to God were willing to sacrifice their lives to be able to set them to circumcise their children, to study Torah, and even not to eat treif. Even not to eat treif. Never mind eating from offerings that have been offered to avodah zarah, which, you know, would fall into the category of the three great averas. But even eating treif, it says eat not unclean food. That means just non-kosher food. That was the approach at the time. Okay. Interestingly, in the next chapter, after Matityahu has already declared his rebellion, we have another case, again, where unprecedented decisions are forced upon the religious leadership of the Jewish people, with no guidance from above. says Matityahu in chapter 2 of Maccabees. Then Matityahu cried out in a loud voice, this after the incident in Modi'in when he killed the Jew who was going to offer up the sacrifice. Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come now to me, me Lashem Eli. And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all they had in the city. Then many who were seeking righteousness and justice went out down to the wilderness to dwell there. They, their sons, their wives, their cattle, because evils pressed heavily upon them. They ran to the city, they ran to the mountains. They left Yerushalayim. They left Modi'in. They left the cities. And they hid in the hills. And anybody knows the area around Har Yehuda knows there were tons of caves and all kinds of places to hide. And it was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, the city of David, that men who had rejected the king's command had gone down to the hiding places in the wilderness. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. And they said to them, and as the Greeks went and they besieged the Jews in the caves, said to them, enough of this. Come out and do what the king commands and you will live. But they said, we will not come out, nor will we do what the king commands, and so profane the Sabbath day. Now, it's not clear what kind of Chil Shabbos, what kind of Sabbath desecration is involved here, but okay. Then the enemy hastened to attack them, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone at them or block up their hiding places. In other words, they didn't move stones. They didn't throw rocks. They didn't do anything to defend themselves or even use rocks to block up the heads of the mouths of the caves. So they said, let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly. So they attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives and children and cattle to a number of 1,000 persons. When Matityahu and his friends learned of it, they mourned for them deeply. And each said to his neighbor, if we all do as our brethren have done, and refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives and for our ordinances, in other words, for our chayim v'chukim v'mishpatim, they will quickly destroy us from the earth. So they made this decision that day, let us fight against every man who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our brethren died in their hiding places. Then they united with them a campaign of Hasidim, mighty warriors of Israel, everyone willing to offer himself willingly for the law. Now the story is problematic. Now, because we all know, Pikuach Nefesh Shtocha Shabbos. And it's really not at all clear why it was that these people refused to fight on Shabbos. Was it there were those who even argued that there was muktzah, they were afraid of using rocks. It's not 100% clear, but what is clear is there were many, many people who either out of knowledge or out of ignorance, it really doesn't matter, said we would rather die than Mimchal Shabbos, and therefore we will let you kill us. Matityahu was forced to take the decision and to put out and say you're wrong. Pikuach nefesh lechima docha Shabbat. Period. That's not an easy thing to say. It's not an easy thing to assert. Apparently, there were those who held that Shabbos should be the overwhelming criterion. You don't reach a situation, a decision like this easily. Again, I don't know exactly what was going through their minds, but again, it meant that they had to take responsibility. Matityahu had to take responsibility. He, together with the Chachmei Ador, sat down and they said, this is a case for Pikuach Nefesh, where everybody else thought, no. Okay. It's interesting to note, so you'll say, okay, fine, that's what you expect from a Rav, but again, let's come back to my first point, and that's going to come up in the next example. It's not that simple. We live in a world where there are no prophets. We live in a world where we expect Talmid Chachamim, where we expect Poskim to have broad shoulders, to take responsibility, to make the difficult decisions, to say yes and to say no, but to face the question under consideration and to do what has to get done. In the second century BCE, it wasn't that simple, as we'll find out in the next story. In Maccabees 1, chapter 4, we have the story of the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple. And when Lysias saw that Lysias had been defeated, and Judah said to his brothers, behold, our enemies are crushed. Let us go up to cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it. So all the army assembled, and they went up to Mount Zion. And they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned, the gates burned. In the courts they saw bushes spring up as a thicket, as one of the mountains. So the Harabai was a total disaster. They also saw the chambers of the priests in ruins. So they rent their clothes, they tore kriya, and mourned with great lamentation, and sprinkled themselves with ashes. They fell down on their faces, and sounded the signal and trumpets, and cried out to heaven. Then Judah detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he cleansed the sanctuary. The situation was as follows. On the area where Al-Aqsa stands, that's really not Harabayim. That is sitting on top of, that's an extension that was built by Herod. It sits probably on the site of what was a fortress, which had been built in order to control the base of Mikdash and control Jerusalem. And even though Judah had conquered Yerushalayim and controlled Harabayim, they still held the Chakra, and the Greeks and their Jewish collaborators. So Judah, in order to rebuild the base of Mikdash, had to actually lay siege and attack the Chakra to keep them busy so they could build the base of Mikdash. Once the Chakra fell a number of years later, Judah had it destroyed. And the only thing that's left is there's a cistern underneath, which is called the Bor HaChakra, to memorialize that fact. So that's from a physical point of view where Al-Aqsa was actually a fortress. In any event, Judas sent a force to keep the forces in the Chakra busy, and who set about the work of restoring the temple. And he writes this, and he says as follows. He chose blameless priests devoted to the law, and they cleansed the sanctuary and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. They deliberated what to do about the altar of burnt offering, which had been profaned, and they thought it best to tear it down, lest it bring reproach upon them, for the Gentiles had defiled it. So they torn down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill until there should come a prophet to tell them what to do with them. Now, they wanted to rebuild the Mizbeach. They wanted to rebuild the altar. But the altar had been desecrated. The altar had been there was an idol put there. They offered non-kosher animals on there. They offered pig on there. So they couldn't use the same altar. So they decided, so really, Paschal had never been done before. What do you do with the defiled altar? So they decided, they said, okay, we're going to destroy the altar. So, but what do you do with the stones? On the one hand, it used to be an altar. On the other hand, it was defiled. On the other hand, it was hektish. What do you do? So he said, you know what? This question we don't need to answer, and we can't answer. And why can't we answer? Because there's no prophet. So they put it aside until a prophet to tell them what to do. Why is this relevant? It's relevant because 250 years after the disappearance of prophecy, they still felt the absence of the prophet. And Chazal confirmed the fact that that's what they did. The Mishnah says in Midos, Perek Aleph Mishnah Vav, that in the Beis HaMikdash, there were four Lashakot, there were four chambers, Bevet HaMoked, okay, in the area of the firehouse. Okay, and he describes all of them. One of them was for lambs, and so on and so forth. And one Mizrachit Tzfonit, one in the northeast. Ba Ganzu Bnei Hashmonai et Avnei Hamizbeach Shishikinsum Chachmei Yavan. That's where in the area of the Beis Hamikdash they put aside these stones till the Navi comes. Why till the Navi comes? Because they don't know what to do, and if they don't have to answer, they didn't have to paskin, they weren't going to paskin. Because they felt the absence of the prophet, of the immediate access to an answer from God. Throughout the book of Maccabees, a number of other places, the author says that this event hadn't happened since prophets had disappeared. This was obviously a real trauma for them to feel alone. And nevertheless, the new circumstances required them to come up with something, to come up with an answer. So what did they do? If they had the answer, they answered. Because the Torah requires that leaders take responsibility. And they use the tools of Torah Shebal Peh to be able to come up with answers. On the other hand, in those cases where it wasn't necessary, they would rather not go. And they would leave it. Teku Tishbi Yitaretz Kushus V'Bayis. Let Elijah take care of it. Let a prophet take care of it. This becomes even more interesting in the last case where this phrase, this need for a prophet, pops up. It's the 14th chapter of Maccabees. This book is already, Judah's gone, and Elazar's dead, and Yonatan's been murdered, and finally the last brother, Simon, he's the one who establishes Jewish rule and Jewish independence, and he becomes the king. And it's in chapter 14, we have the following statement. The king Demetrius recognizes Jewish independence, and he made him one of, and in view of these things, is verse 38, King Demetrius confirmed him in the high priesthood, and he made him one of the king's friends and paid him high honors, for he had heard that the Jews were addressed by the Romans as friends and allies and brethren, and the Romans had received the envoys of Simon with honor, and the Jews and their priests decided that Simon should be their leader and high priest forever until a trustworthy prophet should arise. Why? They made him the leader. What happened? He was a Kohen. They made him Kohen Gadol. That's not a big deal. I mean, that's what's the point? What was it? Because for the first time, a king and a Kohen Gadol were the same. That was the point. In other words, they weren't sure that they were doing the right thing. It's interesting. Chazal record several cases where, in several places, that there was a lot of people were ill at ease with the idea of this mixing of kahuna together with malchus, together with the kingdom. Famous story, the Gemara in Kedushin, Daf Samavav and Aleph tells the story. Tanya, Masa Yanai HaMelech, Yanai HaMelech, who was the grandson of Simon. Shalach lekuklish of a midbar. He went out to a place in the wilderness, and he conquered a number of cities. And after he came back, he made a major party, a celebration for the victory. Amar lehem avotenu vayochlim meluchim bezman sheyoskasukim bebinyan beit hamikdash af anu nochal meluchim zechel avotenu ve'alu meluchim al shulchanot shel zahav achalu. Says, when we rebuilt the temple, they were eating herring, whatever. So we're going to reenact the circumstances of our ancestors, but we're going to eat off of silver and gold to show that we've really made it. Vayasham echad ish letz lev ra ublial ve'elezer ben poira shimon. There was a guy who was a real bad guy. Vayomer eliezer ben poira liana yanai hamelech. Libam shall prushim alecha umayase hakem betitz shebein enecha hakem lahem betitz shebein enav. He says the prushim are against you. Hayasham zakin echad v'Yehuda ben Gedidya shemo. There was a person there was a Gedidya, and he said to him, Yanai hamelech rav lecha keter malchut. It's enough that you're the king. Hanach keter kahuna lezara shel Aaron. You're not really a legitimate kohen. And let somebody else be a Kohen Gadol. Shayu Amrim, because there was a rumor, Imonish Beit B'Modiin, and there was a rumor because his mother had been a Yeshvuya, and that therefore he was a Halal, he was disqualified as a Kohen. Vayivukasha Davar V'lo Nimtzan, it turns out it wasn't true. Vayibadlu Chachmei Yisrael Bizam, and the sages of Israel separated themselves. Well, it's a long story, what the implications are. It's a famous Gemara because of the implications for questions of testimony. I'm not going to go into it. The point is that from the Gemara you see, two reigns later, there was a lot of hesitation about the legitimacy of this combination of Malchus with Kahuna Gedola. Okay? In fact, the Ramban, a famous Ramban, I won't go into it, Ramban said that's why they were punished. Because Lo Yasur Shevet Mihuda Michoket Miben Raglav, this was a violation of the division of powers, separation of powers. Kohen should be a Kohen, and a king should be a king, and goodbye. Even though says the Ramban, the Chashmonaim were wonderful and they were tzaddikim and so on. In this they made a mistake. But you see, in fact, so maybe they made a mistake. But you see from Maccabees, they didn't know what else to do, and they made it contingent upon a Navi Tzedek. They did the best that they could do. The lesson being that, faced with taking responsibility and having to take responsibility based on their best efforts, the Chachmei HaMasora at the time of the Maccabees, faced with unprecedented circumstances, had no other choice but to rely on their own integrity, on their own Yirat Shamayim, on the tools of Torah Shebaal Peh to make a decision. Sometimes they were right. They were right in terms of the laws of Kiddush Hashem. They were right in terms of waging war on Shabbos. They were right in terms of holding off with regard to the to the status of the stones of the Mizbeach, they were right in terms of establishing Hanukkah. Because Hanukkah is a holiday with no scriptural background. Purim at least has the Megillah, about which, albeit there was something of a machlokas initially between, according to the Gemara, between Esther and between the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. But at the end of the day, Purim is based on Kisvei HaKodesh. The whole idea that you could create a holiday which was binding because of the authority of Chazal, this was a chiddush that took responsibility. And that they were, it turned out they were right also. And the decision to make the Kohen Gadol into a king, and this apparently, according to the Ramban, according to many of many other Mefarshim, they made a mistake, but they had to be willing to make mistakes. You don't take responsibility for both the right things and the wrong things. But the most important thing is, in fact, to use it to Torah Sheval Peh, to do it out of case of Yerushalayim, to be able to function in a world where there's no Nis Nigla, only Nis Nister. And that's why I think, more than anything else, Hanukkah is the holiday of Torah Sheval Peh and a symbol and an example for all of us today. Chag Sameach.